Hello neighbours, welcome to Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. I'm Ivan Emke, your host. Have you ever talked to somebody who was truly passionate about plants? Somebody whose eyes glisten as they talk, who seems to know the intimacies, and the Latin name, of any plant you have even a passing acquaintance with? Somebody who positively overflows with useful information. What a joy. Now, imagine that there are two such people in one interview at the same time. That's what we have to look forward to in a moment.
I was more at home in the forest or in the fields than I was in the city, and I still feel that way.
Many people remember collecting dandelion greens for cooking in the spring, probably before any greens were actually available in the garden. And that sort of spring feed of dandelions, I think, is something that people of a certain age remember.
Today we'll move effortlessly across the blurry line between what we call wild plants and what we call domesticated plants. After all, what we learn in one area will help us in the other. My guests today are both longtime interpreters at the Gros Morne National Park and well-recognized experts on that region and beyond. They're naturalists, writers, gardeners, photographers, advisors, keen observers of the world around them. We'll meet in their cozy home in Rocky Harbor. It's late November, what should be a slack time for gardeners, but not for these two. They came in from the garden to talk to me.
I'm Anne Marceau. I've enjoyed the outdoors and tried to find ways to help other people connect with nature.
I'm Michael Brzezinski. I'm a lifelong naturalist. I worked with Parks Canada for many years. Now I'm a photographer and a writer.
Can you remember a first time you realized that plants, wild plants, nature was going to be possibly your life?
For me, it was quite early. I grew up in England. I came to Canada when I was about 10 years old. And we lived first in northern Quebec. And that was a real change from the south of England. This is far northern Quebec in a small iron ore mining town. And some of the first things I learned was that snow can get deeper than 2 inches and last longer than a day. So that was an introduction to a very different ecosystem and very different plants and living style. And then we moved to New Brunswick, and I met naturalists who were associated with Fundy National Park, and that sort of led me on and on into more natural history. My parents used to take us out all the time on trips into the country to collect things like mushrooms and berries and nuts and everything. So it was sort of a natural progression, I think.
So you've always known forests to be food as well?
Food, and almost more home than being in town. I was more at home in the forest or in the fields than I was in the city, and I still feel that way.
How about you, Anne?
Yeah, I think pretty similar. I grew up in a small town. My mother was a gardener. We had a big family, so we always picked berries. She sent us out to gather dandelion greens in, you know, in the spring. My father worked in the forest industry, but he worked as a forester. And so, again, he would always take us out on weekends to, you know, go for walks or visit interesting groves of trees. And you know, while he might have been sizing them up, you know, in terms of their potential as seed stock, for us, it just got us out into those environments as kids. So I don't even know if it was gradual. I think it was almost seeded from a very early age. And then that just grew and grew and grew.
Before we get to wild foods, I must say your garden is amazing, and you've been recognized far and wide if you want to see a good garden. When did this really serious gardening begin?
The first year we moved into this house was 1989, so that's like almost 30 years ago. Yeah. And in the backyard, there was a hole. And I think it had been a sandbox, but it was a place that had no vegetation.
And there was one bush in the front of the house.
But that hole in the backyard became our first garden, and it just grew from there. So yeah. I remember when we were still students working for the summer as naturalists or interpreters in Fundy National Park, and we rented these cabins.
Chicken coops,
refurbished. But we had a lean-to greenhouse on the front of the cabin that we grew tomato plants in.
And we grew zucchinis and old tires because the soil was too shallow.
So, you know what?
A long time.
We've always...
Yeah. We both also have biology backgrounds with a lot of botany courses. From an academic point of view, just wanting to see how things grow and learn a bit more about the plants. And also from the point of view of being able to raise something for a meal later on. Plants are always a fascination for us and still continue to be.
Do you understand at all people who see a hole in their backyard and they make a swimming pool? Does that make any sense to you?
Never quite got that. We do have a bay nearby. So.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Swimming is overrated. Are there things that you knew as students of botany and just in your walk through the forest that then you used when you garden? Are there principles that you've seen in nature that then you apply?
Since we've moved here, we've bought two pieces of land. And certainly just knowing plants well enough that when you see them, you know what kind of soil they're likely to grow in, what kind of moisture conditions they're likely to require. When we bought this piece of land, we could just very easily walk over them and say, this is where the richest soil is, that's where the soil's not very deep, that's a very wet spot over there, so we can't grow certain things there. That's really the most useful thing, I think, from our natural history background as far as gardening is concerned. But also just knowing a little bit about when a plant doesn't look healthy, how to diagnose what the problem is. That's another part of it.
But the point that Michael made about the plants that grow naturally in an area, whether they're truly wild or whether they're, you know, introduced plants that have become established, those plants are indicators, and they tell you something about the particular environment there, especially the soil conditions.
And if you know what you're doing, you can read them from a car as you're driving by. You can see enough in a flash by that you know exactly what the soil conditions are. Irises, for example, if you see the typical blue flag iris, you know that soil is always wet. It never dries out. Yeah. If you see certain grasses and certain sedges, you know that that's very poor soil. It's going to be shallow. It's going to be depleted. There are a whole pile of indicators like that you can grasp in just a second as you're going by.
So then if you're going to garden, you then know what you might need to do to kind of amend that. And there's some amendments that you can do, you know, if the soil is too peaty or too sandy, if it's an area that's wet, well, then you maybe select the kind of crops that are tolerant of moisture. Anyway, so we play with that.
Yeah. Is there a principle behind getting people out and seeing flowers and identifying them and seeing plants in the wild that helps them look at the world in a different way?
One of the fascinating things about working with people is that you sometimes do get to see something click when you're showing them something or when they're understanding something, and all of a sudden the world is different from their point of view. They understand that there's a lot more out there, there's a lot more to learn, that they have greater connection to something, and people do kind of blossom from that. It's really fascinating to watch. E.O. Wilson's idea of biophilia it kind of ties into that. The idea that we as animals are programmed to live in a more natural environment than we have in our homes now. And that's why we have the houseplants, and you're right standing in front of me, kind of surrounded by houseplants and looking out a window at a garden. And the whole idea of us needing to welcome those things into our lives, that is really an important part of being human, and something that if you don't have it, you really miss. It means that you will grow up in a very strange way.
The other thing about helping people develop their own connection to nature, I think we all relate to food, right? Which comes in a sense back to the thing that you're exploring. We do relate to food. And so when you're on a walk with people, things that you can taste or things that you can come to recognize or associate with foods that you already know, maybe something that's related, or if you can connect back to something that you did as a child, because I think kids are much more prone, both because children are curious and also because we've moved away from that, maybe as adults are more likely to taste things and, you know, try things, or people connect back with values of frugality and maybe eating wild foods that they may have either heard their parents talk about or maybe their grandparents. So there can be a heritage connection to nature through food, or there can just be that, aha, yeah, that thing that we're sampling, well, it's very small and it doesn't necessarily have a lot of food, but it's related to something that we now cultivate and eat widely. Like the beach peas that you find growing all along the you know, coastal areas. It's like, oh my gosh, like people they'll often even recognize them as peas, right? And they'll say, are those peas? And you say, well, yeah, they're the beach peas, and you won't get a lot of food out of them because they're only tiny little peas, but people can click and say, oh my goodness, so the cultivated peas, you know, came from something like that, that humans domesticated them.
Tastes and smells and things like that do stick in people's minds. Certainly, when you let people taste the wintergreen flavor of yellow birch or of a tea berry or something like that, that brings back all sorts of memories.
Do you have a piece of music that I can play underneath this? Something that you hum in the garden, or
or
I can email you afterwards.
Yeah, that might be easier.
Yeah, I think about it.
And they did send me some music suggestions, 11 of them to be precise. Like their garden, their music choices are an embarrassment of riches. Here's a couple of them, folded together. That's Yo-Yo Ma with Bach's Suite for Solo Cello No. 1 in G Major Part 6, The Jig, as well as Chantal Perrier-Layec with François Couperin's Les Barricades Mystérieuses, by request from my guests today, Anne Marceau and Michael Brzezinski. I start this section by asking about wild edible plants, but right away I get sidetracked into talking about fungi.
In Newfoundland and Labrador, in forests and bogs and so on and so forth, there are a number of edible plants. What are some of your favorites?
How far can we stretch the definition of the word plant?
How far would you like to?
Well, things such as fungi, which one time used to be considered to be plants, but now we know they're a completely different kingdom, are a really important component of edible things you can find. Mm-hmm. And unlike moose, you don't actually have to shoot them down. You can actually go and pick them more or less like a plant. So in England and in parts of North America, fungi are still regarded with a lot of suspicion. In a lot of other parts of the world, they're Eastern Europe, they're a national sport. France, Germany, Switzerland, places like that. Mushroom hunting is a great deal of fun, and we have many, many species that are edible more than once, and some of them are very, very nice. They're excellent flavors. They're available in large quantities. I think we've eaten about 30 different species over the years, and there are some excellent mushrooms available once you get to know them. But do make sure that you know them before you eat them, because there are also some hideously poisonous ones. So it's a dangerous sport, but it's a great one. The other interesting thing about the mushrooms is that you can come back and find them growing in the same place year after year, because the organism is usually either under the ground in the soil or in local tree trunks. And what you're picking is not the actual organism, it's just the fruit of the fungus. So by removing the mushrooms, you're not harming the organism itself. You're just removing the fruit, the things that will disperse its spores to produce other ones. So it's more like picking apples off a tree.
On an apple tree every year, you can come back. As long as the apple tree is still alive, it'll continue to produce apples. Maybe because I grew up in New Brunswick, but to me, the essential wild food is fiddleheads.
You have to start the year off properly. Huh? You have to start the year off properly.
That is such a spring tradition. And when we first moved here to Newfoundland, I guess because we just didn't come across fiddleheads, we thought, oh, well, I guess they just don't, you know, grow here in Newfoundland. And then, lo and behold, we started noticing, here. And then we started looking. And now there's loads of places to find fiddleheads, during a fairly small window, maybe sort of a 3 week, maybe up to a month window around the May long weekend and leading into early June.
On the west coast of Newfoundland.
Are there wild plants that you have decided to grow in your garden?
A wild plant I remember as a child, and a number of Newfoundlanders have shared this story, is the wild hazelnut or the beaked hazel, which is a nut that grows on a shrub. And so in our garden, we haven't so much chosen to grow them, but where we found them growing on the edges of the properties, we encourage them. You know, we'll clear out a few other trees around them to kind of make sure they get enough sun. Another shrub, this was one we actually transplanted, was what I call an amelanchier. Amelanchier is the Latin name, but again, people in Newfoundland would probably know them as...
Chucky pears, right?
Or Saskatoon, they'd be called in Western Canada. But I mean, they grow wild. Yeah. They grow, in the woods around here. And we transplanted a small shrub. I mean, it might have been 2 or 3 feet tall. It produces some berries, but again, you know, often the birds get them before we do. Mm. But it's fun just to grow them and to know them, not necessarily because we need to eat them. Yeah. Growing down in the meadow, there's wild caraway growing
everywhere.
Anywhere you get an old field, you're going to find.
So how do you use wild caraway?
It's exactly the same as regular caraway. Yeah.
It has the same flavor.
Late summer when the seeds arrive, just rub them off into a paper bag, let them dry out, and they're exactly the same as regular caraway. Yeah. Another one that we use, we don't have in the garden itself, is lovage. When we're cooking mussels, we used to run down to the shore and get a couple of sprigs of Scotch lovage and throw that in, and it gives a really wonderful flavor to mussels. Now we have
a
European lovage growing in the garden. The wild lovage here grows about half a meter high. The one that we have in the garden grows about 2.5 meters high. It's a bit massive, but it has the same flavor. It's very, very nice.
Were there things that people used to eat here that you're aware of that we don't anymore?
Going back to the lovage, if you go up to the Labrador Straits, people there call it Alexander's, and they very often use it as a spring vegetable. They'll harvest the young stems and boil them and have them just with butter and salt. And that's sort of the equivalent of fiddleheads for the Labrador Straits for a lot of people.
Many people remember collecting dandelion greens. I mean, that isn't necessarily something that you grew. Because
fortunately, you don't have to.
No, exactly. That's nature's bounty. Yeah, like a number of people remember as kids probably going out, you know, being told to go out and collect some of the dandelion leaves for cooking in the spring, probably before any greens were actually available, you know, in the garden and so on. But that sort of spring feed of dandelions, I think, is something that people of a certain age probably, remember. Rose root, which grows along sort of rocky shorelines in near Natsiavut, the northern part of Labrador. Many of the Inuit there remember eating the leaves
in the summer, and then just dipping them in
molasses. Yeah,
and having it just kind of as a sweet.
And I think rose root, at least when we first heard about this, it seemed like there was almost a bit of a movement to try to encourage people to remember or learn about. to go back to some of these foods. So lovage would have been one of them.
Yeah. Well, even some mushrooms, because up in northern Labrador, when you get into the tundra areas, the trees are all just little creeping dwarf birches and dwarf willows and things like that, flat on the ground. But in summer, the mushrooms that are associated with the roots of those trees bear their fruit, and the mushrooms are actually towering over these little trees that are like 10 centimeters, 15 centimeters high, whereas the trees themselves are only a couple of centimeters high. Some of the elders have memories of using those mushrooms, because a lot of them are things like lixinums that are certainly very edible. We had some when we were up there.
There's another spring green, which I think I haven't eaten it, but I've got a number of friends who do, and that's nettles, stinging nettles. Mm-hmm. This spring I was going to try it. The problem is, I mean, we grow so much stuff in the garden, and we have so many things started early that it's almost like I don't
want nettles in the garden.
Well, yes, right? No, definitely don't want them in the garden. But they often grow in fairly rich soil around old home sites.
Especially outhouses. barns are a typical place. Yeah. Any fallen down barn is.
But the actual stinging part of the nettle, you know, breaks down
on cooking.
Cooking, what you would wind up with would be a vegetable that's almost kind of like spinach that would just, you know, wilt completely.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a couple of other plants. Labrador tea is one we haven't talked about.
That's
a good country tea that people throughout Newfoundland and Labrador have used.
Yeah.
It's in the blueberry family, but it's also related to things like lambkill and leatherleaf. And a lot of those plants have alkaloids, toxins that protect them from herbivores.
Right.
And depending on how you prepare them, you can either avoid the toxins or you can just eat the parts that don't have them. But the Labrador tea, the leaves are leathery, they stay on for a couple of years, and they tend to fold over at the edges. They're incurled underneath, and if you turn the leaf over, you'll see it's either covered with very dense felt of white hairs for the New Year's leaves, or cinnamon-colored brownish hairs for the previous year's leaves, and both of them make a good tea. The thing you should do, though, is be careful, don't boil them, because if you boil them, you will extract alkaloids, whereas if you just pour hot water over them, so less than boiling water over them, let them steep for probably about 5 minutes. They take a while. Yeah. Then you get the nice flavor, but you don't get the toxins and the bitterness that you'd get if you boil them. You can also just suck on them. There's a very nice flavor that way, too.
Just as you're hiking along.
Yeah, okay. Just a couple of leaves, and you get it. It's almost like spruce gum. They're the same sort of flavor in some ways.
Yeah, it's resin. It's resinous. That's how I would describe the taste. Sweet, but a bit resinous.
So, also things like magna tea berries or creeping tea berry or dwarf wintergreen or creeping snowberry, as little tiny white berries and tiny round green leaves that grow almost like vines over stumps and banks. Mm-hmm. That's a very nice plant for making tea. It's one of the few white berries that's safe to eat. They taste very strongly of wintergreen, or you can just take the leaves and make a tea out of them. Again, and don't overheat them, but they make a nice wintergreen flavored tea.
Instead of having screeching in, you should develop a different thing where people drink some of this tea and they learn the Latin for something else. Or, as if you have no other things to do.
That's concertina player Jody Kruskal with a tune called Heidi's Pleasure, by recommendation of my guests today, Michael Brzezinski and Anne Marceau. Back to our conversation during the waning lights of a chilly November day.
When we think about what kind of crops we should be growing here in Newfoundland and Labrador, knowing as you do, nature here, the soils, the climate, kinds of plants that do well. Does anything strike you as being a crop that we should be growing more of?
When you think about wild food, berries are sort of the one big group that comes to mind because they're abundant. Some of them grow beautifully in the wild, but it's a question maybe of protecting their habitat, right?
Yeah,
so that
yeah.
people can, I mean, like bake apples. I mean,
yeah.
they grow in bogs, right?
Yeah.
Well, if they're growing wild and if they're abundant and it's like the rose root along the seashore, or the lovage along the seashore, or the oyster leaf that grows along the seashore. I mean, all of those things, you know, could they be cultivated? Is there enough of a market for them? Or is it just maybe more important to sort of protect the areas
yeah.
that they grow, or the kinds of areas that they grow yeah. in, and let those areas kind of remain wild or semi-wild. I mean,
yeah.
lots of
a lot of those yeah. populations also wouldn't sustain if people did decide to start collecting them. It wouldn't be sustainable because the plants would be wiped out very quickly. A few years ago, the province was encouraging the cultivation of rose root of rhodiola because there was a strong market, I think, in Russia, where it's used as a nutraceutical. I.e., it was dipped in vodka. not dip, but bottled in vodka and used as for goodness knows what, but
everything
yes oh me gout
yeah.
right. So the problem there is if you're depending on wild populations, you'd very quickly strip it out. In the same way that Taxol, the use of Taxol for breast cancer control led to a depletion of a lot of sites on the west coast of the wild yew because that was the only way it could be derived at that point.
I guess the thing about what foods we look at cultivating or collecting, it kind of comes down to what the objective is, doesn't it? And one of those things is, are we growing this because it's something we think we can sell, or is it because it's something that's going to contribute to providing food source locally that can be locally grown, locally consumed. I mean, I don't know if we need to necessarily look at some of the wild foods, but even if we just look at some of the foods that are suited to our climate and the whole, like you mentioned, I mean, the root crops, which are very traditional as part of the Newfoundland diet, because they can also be stored. But there's a lot of, you know, all of the mustard family, all the cabbage
yeah,
greens,
yeah.
all of the, you know, the bok choys and the pak
right.
choys
mm-hmm.
and the, I mean, there's just so many plants that are in that cabbage family.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you grow these more leafy crops, you could have greens in 40 days or
yeah,
50 days
yeah.
and,
yeah.
you know, a much quicker turnaround. And you wouldn't need to grow them in a greenhouse.
Wow. So it's the middle of November and you apparently still have garden work to do. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. We, because the snow is so deep here and because we get a lot of drifting and the possibility of ice clinging to the plants, we have a real problem with the lower branches being snapped off, broken off trees or pulled right out of the sockets in some cases. And so we, even after many years, we still wrap a lot of plants. So the lower branches are pulled in against the trunk just to stop them from being too heavily damaged by snow slumping. We also wrap things because although we don't have as many moose now that there's hunting in the park, and moose used to be a massive problem in our garden, now we have lots of snowshoe hares. And they're just as bad, just shorter. That's the only difference. And so blessed snowshoe hares have been coming through and eating all of our woody plants. And you still have some leeks in the garden and parsnips in the garden.
Parsnips overwinter beautifully. I left some carrots in the garden somewhat intentionally, but I usually bring carrots in and keep them in moist sand, and I just thought, well, what if I leave some in the garden and just sort of see, you know, how they do. Yeah, I still have some kale in the garden. I covered it with a bit of straw, and they were ones that I had planted sort of in late August to kind of create a fall crop.
Well, it's so refreshing. Yeah. Some people say, you know, the Newfoundland growing season is just a few months, but you go from March to December.
Because you start seeds indoors, and then
almost finished off the tomatoes.
Yeah, so on the counter, those are...
They're beautiful.
Almost the last. I think those are the last. I think there's maybe half a dozen still down.
Thanks, Anne and Michael, so much for taking the time out of your gardening here in the middle of November to have a chat.
Happy to do that.
I don't know about you, but this conversation gave me a renewed view of the world around me. I was inspired for all of my hikes to come and the chance to learn from wild plants, to steep up some wintergreen tea and chew on some sweet but resinous Labrador tea leaves.
One of the fascinating things about working with people is that you sometimes do get to see something click when you're showing them something, and all of a sudden the world is different from their point of view.
The plants that grow naturally in an area, whether they're truly wild or whether they're, you know, introduced plants that have become established, those plants are indicators, and they tell you something about the particular environment there, especially the soil conditions.
This has been Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. To listen to other episodes of this show or for more information, go to fittoeatnl.ca. The songs for today's show were Suite for Solo Cello No. 1 in G Major Part 6 by Yo-Yo Ma, Les Barricades Mystérieuses played by Chantal Perrier-Layek, and Heidi's Pleasure by Jody Kushkal. The theme music, Cluck Old Hen, was performed this week by the Lost Echo String Band. This is a production of Kitchen Table Communications. I'm Ivan Emke. Join me again next time. Happy trails.
Plants are always a fascination for us, and still continue to be.